Good afternoon, and welcome to CSIS. On behalf of Dr. John Hamry, our president, we're delighted to launch this report, a part of our Smart Power Initiative. It is an honor to be here today with two distinguished leaders, Ambassador John Negroponte and Senator Timothy Wirth. Both men have personally served this country throughout their careers as promoters of what we now call smart power. I need not repeat the biographical statements of either man, but it would be remiss of me not to mention that when it comes to the topic of today's program, a new multilateralism, a smart power approach to the United Nations, both Ambassador Negroponte, as a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, among other positions, and Senator Timothy Wirth, president of the United Nations Foundation, truly understand the potential and the promise of an institution that has endured and weathered more than 64 years of international crises and is still going strong. When CSIS first launched its Smart Power Commission in 2006, chaired by two CSIS trustees, Ambassador Richard Armitage and Professor Joseph Nye, the idea was to see how the U.S. could develop a strategy and a set of policies on U.S. global engagement, which included recommendations for the next president. The premise of the report, released in 2007, focused on how America could restore its leadership and become a smarter power. And it diagnosed the problem, warning that U.S. influence in the world, waning U.S. influence in the world, and recognized a remedy, a smart power approach to managing our relationships with friends and allies, but also with international organizations. Smart power is really an integrated strategy and one that brings together both hard and soft power in the American toolkit of programs and assets, a strong military, strong civilian institutions, but also a long history of a relationship, alliances, and partnerships with institutions old and new. Among the most important and continuously used tool of our smart power has been the United Nations, founded in 1945 by President Franklin Roosevelt. It still endures. The Smart Power Commission identified several key areas where participation in the UN can further America's desire to promote global good: peacekeeping and peacebuilding, counterterrorism, global health, and energy and climate change. As a part of the Smart Power Project, I, Johanna Mendelson, I did not mention my name, was asked to write a separate paper about the role of the United Nations as a part of the President's toolkit for advancing U.S. interests in a more complex and challenging global environment. A copy of the report is available to you today. On a personal note, I must acknowledge that it is as I sit here with two giants in the field. I've had the pleasure to work with Senator Wirth at the United Nations Foundation, whose Better World campaign helped support our Smart Power Project. And as a Latin Americanist, I have always admired the work of Ambassador Negroponte, not only at the UN, but in his various efforts to support the Americas in this hemisphere. It is an honor to let Ambassador Negroponte begin this conversation and to have Senator Wirth continue the dialogue. But this dialogue will not be a dialogue unless we have you all participate, all of you who are serious students of this subject. And so we will open the floor to you, ladies and gentlemen, when both gentlemen have made their statements. Thank you.
Shall I start?
I think.
Thank
you. We're going to all sit down.
Thank you, Johanna.
Thank you.
And first of all, thank you for inviting me to participate in this conversation. Thank you to Senator Wirth also. The other thing I'd like to say is I enjoyed your paper. I thought it was, and as I told you before we started our discussion, I think it's spot on in terms of the areas that you recommend be a focus of multilateralism, and particularly at the UN. And I, just at the risk of repeating them here, I commend you all to page 4 of the report and the 5 issues that are listed there: preventing and managing state failure through peacekeeping operations, addressing borderless threats posed by the spread of infectious diseases, bringing together the North and South to deal with the threats posed by climate change, supporting treaty-based efforts to prevent proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and providing humanitarian relief for natural disaster and man-made emergencies. My own background in dealing with the UN, of course, I've dealt with multilateral issues throughout my diplomatic career, but as representative to the UN in 2001 to period 2001-2004, I had the the opportunity to represent us at the Security Council, and I counted them once. I think it was something like 200 Security Council resolutions were passed during the time I was perm rep there. And I guess the first thing I'd really say is the UN matters, notwithstanding the rhetoric of the critics, notwithstanding those who are utterly dismissive of the UN. I mean, we passed resolutions, some a little more heavyweight than others, but that had a bearing on the lives of people. And since UN Security Council resolutions are binding on all the member states, it's a serious international legislative function, if you will. And when I first got there in the wake of 9/11. I got there on the 17th or 18th, I can't recall, 18th, 17th of September 2001. Within a matter of days, we had passed a major resolution regarding terrorist financing, Resolution 1373, that has actually provided the legal basis for a lot of countries to go after terrorist finances around the world. And had it not been for that resolution, many of those countries would have argued that they do not have the legal faculty to do that. So I was exposed to the utility of the United Nations in a very practical way right from the start. On peacekeeping, one of the first things I did in the run-up to my confirmation to be ambassador to the UN was to study the situation in Sierra Leone, because that was the sort of exhibit A at the particular time. And for those of you who recall that situation, it was positively desperate. There was all manner of terrible things happening throughout that country because of these criminal groups. The government was holed up in a small enclave, a tiny place where it really had no writ whatsoever throughout the country. And we mounted, definitely with the help of the British, who played the country of the lead country, and they sent troops of their own. But along with that, we mounted a rather large peacekeeping operation during the time I was there. I think it got up to 17,000 troops at one point. And today, I mean, Sierra Leone, I would say, relatively speaking, is a success story. There's no more a peacekeeping operation there, and the country is relatively quiet and peaceful. And you can cite other similar examples. Liberia is another one. So to some of my Republican brethren who were a little more critical of the UN than I am, I used to say, first of all, you got to distinguish what UN you're talking about. That's one of the difficulties in the conversation about the United Nations. Different people mean different things when they talk about the UN. Some just have in mind the Secretariat, and then they want to find anything that they can find wrong with the Secretariat, magnify it, sometimes out of proportion, and then use it as a justification for saying the entire organization isn't worth it. To me, of course, having been the perm rep and having probably spent more of my time, some people might have said a disproportionate amount of my time, but in any case, more if not most of my time on the Security Council, I tended to look at it from that angle, and the angle of the world's larger powers and those other elected members of the Security Council having an opportunity to really influence the course of events, particularly with regard to peacekeeping. My other experience over the years, not only when I was stationed in New York, was with the UN humanitarian agencies. And there, I've got to refer all the way back to the exodus from Vietnam in the late 1970s and the extraordinary job that the UN High Commission for Refugees did at that time in dealing with this exodus of literally hundreds of thousands of people landing on the shores of various countries in Southeast Asia. And that performance will always remain with me when I think about the kind of work that the humanitarian agencies could do. Ditto the World Food Program, ditto UNICEF, and so forth. So I, for one, first of all, think, you know, the UN's going to be there whether we like it or not. There's nothing. It's going to be here for the rest of the century. I don't see happening to the UN what happened to the League of Nations. I don't think it's that transient an organization. I think it's going to be around. People aren't going to throw up their arms 20 years from now and say, well, maybe we ought to start all over again. So I think it behooves us to think about how to make it effective. And secondly, I think when we debate this issue in the United States, we got to think more about how it, working with the United Nations and working through the United Nations, can best serve our interests. I think there is a, even amongst those who accept the UN in our polity as a important organization, sometimes even subconsciously look for ways to avoid going through the United Nations. And I won't bore you with examples about that now. We can come back to that issue later. But I guess enough said by way of introductory remarks. I guess if it hadn't come across already, I'm for working with the United Nations.
Well, great, John. It's always a pleasure to be with you. And John represented absolutely the best of the State Department and its leadership and its commitment to cooperating with the UN. You know, there have been obviously times when that was not the case, and I think those were also times in which the UN didn't work very well. You know, I would argue first and foremost that the UN works when the U.S. wants it to work, and that the UN has a very difficult time when the U.S. stands in the way, when the U.S. is making it difficult for the UN to work, and that that when we recognize the fact that the UN is in the U.S. national interest, and it's very important for the U.S. to figure out how the UN is a major tool of U.S. policies one way or another, as well as our overall far-reaching, say, ideological and moral commitments around the world. But when you think about just what is in our interest, that it's a very, very important relationship. I don't know how many of you saw this morning's Washington Post. There's a picture in this morning's Washington Post of members of the staff of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, the same agency that John was talking about, dealing with refugees coming out of Vietnam, dealing with refugees coming out of the Swat Valley, Pakistan. Mm. Now, you can think of no place that's in our greater national interest right now than having an agency and having a having a group of people dealing with one of the most problematic, difficult places in the world, dealing with them with great effectiveness, and being in places where, I mean, how many people are voluntarily going to spend time heading off to Sierra Leone or heading off to Liberia at those roughest times, or heading into the Swat Valley and dealing with a flow of, you know, some of the most helpless and vulnerable people in the world. I mean, it is the UN doing that, and that is in our interest, obviously, for a whole series of reasons that that be done, and that that be done very well. John mentioned in particular his experience working on the Security Council, and it is the Security Council resolutions that probably get the greatest amount of political attention in the United States and also generate probably the greatest amount of frustration in the United States. Why can't the UN, quote, solve that problem? The answer, of course, is normally that nothing gets to the Security Council unless it's not solvable someplace else, that some regional grouping or some political grouping or a government has failed or whatever, and you have a real failure and that problem works its way up to the Security Council. You know, and so therefore they're dealing with what I think for the most part are the most difficult problems and the most intractable issues in some of the most impossible, geographically, the most impossible areas of the world. You know, thank God they're there. As George Shultz would say and has said, I've heard him say over and over and over again, if the UN weren't there, we'd have to reinvent it, and we wouldn't do nearly as good a job the second time around. But it's that side of the UN, it's sort of the blue helmet, political side of the UN that gets, I think, the greatest amount of focus and attention and frustration and causes the kinds of political problems that the UN has, say, in the United States of America. It's the other side of the UN. It's the softer side of the UN, the soft power side. I see Esther Coopersmith coming in here. Esther is probably Ms. Soft Power for the United Nations. If you all don't know, Esther Coopersmith has probably been the number one cheerleader for the UN for 40 years in Washington. I am going to single her out because she's very important. Esther, welcome. Thank you very much for all you. But anyway, on the soft power side, on the soft side of the United Nations, that's the side where constituencies exist for the U.S., for the UN around the country, and where those of us who are supporters of the UN and the UN Foundation's job is to try to support the mission of the UN and to support UN causes. You know, that's where we have to work with the UN and do a much better job of organizing those constituencies, organizing those positive voices on behalf of the UN, and putting them into the form of a small p political constituency in support of the UN as a small p political institution. You know, we have to remember that all of these large governmental institutions are fundamentally political institutions. They draw their power from someplace else. You know, they're not making money, they're not drawing power from the bottom line. They're drawing power from that which is given to them by some other kind of political authority. And they have to have a constituency, therefore. Just like the Congress and members of Congress have to have a constituency. Departments of the government have to have a constituency. Although it's very difficult for the State Department to do that, the State Department, you know, has to learn to reach out and have a constituency to build support for what it's doing, you know, across the American public. And the UN, you know, has to learn to do the same thing. And there are, fortunately, a whole series of very positive constituencies out there, you know, that are, for the most part, more narrow than we'd like to see, but they exist. You think about the constituency for women and UNFPA and the focus on the extraordinary job that was done at the Cairo conference in 1994 and the whole change in the way in which women and reproductive health issue norms were set around the world. There's a very strong constituency for the UN and UNFPA. If you think about just what we've just been through with the swine flu, you know, what public health is all about is surveillance and information and norms that get sent for, you know, what is the proper kind of behavior and how do you deal with a situation. And that's what the World Health Organization does, like our own Center for Disease Control. Then there's a very significant constituency there, and we have to make sure that people understand what the UN has done and how effective the UN can and should be. The SARS threat that we had a few years ago, the UN was out on the cutting edge of that, again, in very close cooperation with the U.S. Center for Disease Control, in spiking that, making sure that we understood what it was, what had to be done, and where we were headed. You know, dealing with refugees, which is a growing number of refugees around the world. I mentioned the Swat Valley situation is an example of many, many others. There are now 30 million, I believe, 30 million refugees living around the world who are people without any homes, who are fed largely, taken care of largely by the UNHCR, fed by the UN. I think the UN food program is today feeding more than 50 million people in the world, and I think we can see that coming down the road that's going to be significantly more. Final point that I'd make in terms of constituencies and how much this means to the American public and means to various parts of the American public, perhaps, is to talk about the AIDS issue. One of the most interesting phenomena that has occurred in the United States has been the growth of the evangelical community, 100 electoral votes right down the middle of the country, engaged in American politics in a way that's not happened before. And 15 years ago, that constituency was quite narrowly focused on politics and who got elected. But increasingly, we see that constituency broadening its base and broadening its set of interests very, very significantly, so much so that it was really the alliance of the AIDS community with the evangelical community with the AIDS community in the United States that led the Bush administration to drive the PEPFAR program, the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief, into probably the most successful or the most well-known initiative of much of the Bush foreign policy. And here was a constituency saying we have a moral obligation to deal with this particular problem. Funds flowed as a result. There was an alliance made in American politics, and that turned out to be very, very effective. What we now have to do is to learn how to, from that lesson, you know, how do we learn from that lesson and develop other constituencies in support of the common U.S.-UN mission? And maybe the next big test, and I'll stop with this, is going to be climate change, you know, where we have this enormous challenge. You know, like AIDS, it's something that has to be legitimized. People have to come to understand it. There's a base of information out there. The UN provides that. It's the UN's job then to bring countries together and to begin to develop a set of norms for how we're going to handle this growing, looming crisis of climate. And how do we put the constituencies together? Various parts of the UN trying to learn how to do that. In various parts of our own domestic politics, learning how to trying to learn how to do that. If we can do as good job on climate change as was done by some on AIDS, you know, we're going to be able to get a climate treaty and really be able to make some headroads in this, some inroads on this. That's a good example for us to use. This is all what's in the U.S. interest, what's in the U.N. interest. When the two work together, you know, we really make a major dent on a whole series of terribly important issues around the world, all of which have somewhere a political constituency that we got to figure out how to organize and tie into the mission.
Well, thank you both for such good opening statements. Let me just start with a question. I think both of you expressed the fact that moving forward, multilateralism is a way to move on our agenda that supports U.S. interests. And yet we're still finding the same constituencies that opposed support of the U.N. in our own Congress continuing to go completely against some of the interests that we all agree are essential, from supporting peacekeeping and peace building to our support of the UNFPA, despite the good work that President Obama did to change some of the policies. So what is the solution, given the need for these constituencies domestically to support the U.S. interest?
Well, I'll start, John, is to think about this. First of all, let's think about the budget you mentioned there, you know, right away. You know, we've got the A-team there now. You know, I think you've got, you know, Senator, President, obviously, very committed to the U.N. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, very committed to the U.N. Susan Rice, you couldn't have a better person, closer connections to the President there. And it's already bearing fruit. The administration came in, approximately $1 billion deficit. The U.S. was in arrears by about $1 billion. And if you look at the supplemental and next year's budget, this administration is practically taking care of that, saying we are going to do that. We're going to pay our bills. We're not going to be the biggest scofflaw in the world. We're going to take care of this. We're going to work on this. Now, where will they get the votes for that? How will they get the votes for that? How will they continue to get that? Budgets, you know, really tell an awful lot about what priorities are. And again, I think building this constituency is going to be extremely important. You've got getting these various constituent elements organized in support of this to let members of the Appropriations Committee and let their members of Congress know that this kind of funding and this kind of support is important. I think much of this is a constituency process, and that means telling your story. That means having a narrative. You know, why is what the UN's doing on reproductive health is important? Why what happens in the Swat Valley is important? Remember what happened in Vietnam, you know, 35 years ago. That was very important. You know, this narrative, these political stories have to be knit together and have to be told, and we have to come up and recognize that. Now, it's terribly hard for the UN to do that. The UN can't come and get engaged in American politics You know, that is anathema to the UN and not something it can do. So that gets left to institutions like CSIS and our own and so on to try to, it's our responsibility then to help to get these stories told.
I mean, it's interesting because after making my remarks, I start putting down a few notes to myself, and the first word I wrote down was arrears. And it was more in the context of trying to do a list of the few things I felt we could do that were practical, short term, but would be visible demonstrations of support for the United Nations and for multilateralism. And I couldn't agree more that dealing with the arrears question is very important. I would add one thing to what Tim had to say about that, which is constituency, fine, all well and good. But my experience with foreign policy suggests to me that unless you have strong leadership from the president himself and the secretary of state, you ain't going to get there. Mm-hmm. So I think it requires a combination.
That's right.
It really needs a combination of two. And let me just go one step further. I mean, I have been in many sessions through the various jobs I had in the last administration where the president say, this is a great idea, and the secretary would say, gee, it's good, we ought to do it. And we'd have the decision come out of the National Security Council. And then the OMB would come back to us and say, oh, by the way, that $1 billion for the arrears, tell us what program you're going to cut in the State Department to pay the $1 billion to the United Nations. So the budgetary aspect sometimes becomes a little more complicated than just the spur-of-the-moment decision that is taken in a National Security Council meeting. And you got to be sure you've got all different parts of our executive branch tied together on this.
Well, we've given up worrying about budgets in this administration.
Well, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
You know what I mean. Yeah, you know, it's easy for people to say, yeah, that's a great idea. It's another for them to think through the finances of it.
But you're right about leadership. You know, one of the things that John was, just before this effort, we put together a letter to Senator McCain and Senator Obama just before the election on the interests of the UN and the U.S. and why this cooperative relationship had to be strengthened and was so very important. And one of the recommendations on that, John, was that the President of the United States should, for the first time, go to the UN and make a speech to the United States from the UN. Never happened before.
You mean not just addressing the General Assembly?
Not just to go to the UN and say to the UN, 1, 2, 3, 4,
right, yeah.
But to use that platform as a place, as a venue, as an architecture to explain a foreign policy of the United States and how to change. To go to your very points, why are we investing in a new multilateralism? You know, again, I still think this is a good idea. I think you're right, the leadership and the visibility of that, saying, you know, why are we using that as a platform for explaining to the American public, you know, why we're doing this, why this is important, and why your tax dollars are going to this. Again, we have to continue to work on these efforts, and you're absolutely correct about the leadership issue. That's true everywhere, of course. But
well, we have leadership, and actually Ambassador Negroponte mentioned how busy he was with Security Council resolutions. Just one little factoid, that during the Bush administration, 1/4 of all Security Council resolutions that have ever been made within the United Nations came out of that period. So it's a very was a time that we had a lot of movement using the UN as a very important multilateral tool, but not necessarily having the endorsement to move forward. So looking forward, I just want to see if we can, in our audience, who have been patiently waiting their turn, I see many UN advocates in this room and also many people with ideas might like to pose some questions to our speakers if they wouldn't mind entertaining them. And before I do that, I want to recognize two other people, Carol McGifford, who was the chair of the staff direction for the Smart Power Commission, is with us, and Rick Barton, who was the member of the commission and also a former UN Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees is here, so I wanted to recognize both of you as well, as this is, they were all integral parts of this project. But I'm
God, Rick, we were both bragging on your institution. I mean, that's pretty. We saw you come in. That was.
That was probably the reason. But can I ask people in the audience if they would like?
You know what? Just on that, just to think about what's coming at us too, on the refugee area and climate change. The deputy head of HCR the other day gave a speech and said that under current projections of what's going to happen in terms of the impacts of climate change, the numbers of refugees are going to grow from 20 plus million to, I think the numbers that he was using was the neighborhood of 300 million refugees. I mean, the climate forcing refugee flows. I mean, imagine what happens in Bangladesh. You know, in the lowlands there alone, imagine, you know, 50% of the people in the world live within 15 miles of coastlines. I mean, it's extraordinary numbers. And then, you know, how are we going to deal with all of that?
There's no law on environmental refugees.
Where do these people fit? What happens? Where do they go? What kind of pressure is it going to be? Absolutely. This is going to be a horrendous issue. And who deals with it? How do we deal with it? How do we start to think about it? You know, that's going to fall right smack in the middle of the, right in the lap of the United Nations to try to help to figure this through. Sorry, I was just...
No, I think that's a very critical point, and I'd like to see if other people would like to join the conversation.
There's a gentleman over there.
Yes. Do we have a mic? Okay, thank you.
People can identify themselves, too. Can
yes,
they stand
you
up and
mind,
identify?
Just stating your name and your affiliation.
The Cato Institute. It seems to me one of the big challenges to the United Nations Security Council is responsibility to protect. And Kosovo, the idea was it's legitimate but not legal. But if you tell the Russians and the Chinese, primarily, that they get to exercise their veto when we let them, what respect will they have for the United Nations? Won't they try then to make alternative arrangements? And isn't there, as a consequence, the possibility of the world dividing again the way it did during the Cold War?
If I get the sense of your question, I mean, you're saying that there's the risk that they will start using the veto too often?
Or they will ignore it. As in Georgia, if you have a responsibility to protect, so do we.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then what happens to the UN Security Council structure?
Well, I mean, we've been the ones who probably use the veto more than anybody else over the years, but I guess the answer to your question is we just got to keep trying to make effective, and the more successes that you can accumulate or rack up, I think the greater the chance that you're going to be able to make it a viable institution going forward. There has been a tendency over history to limit the scope of the range of Security Council jurisdiction. I mean, like the Vietnam conflict, for example, it never came under the Security Council, in certain other areas as well. There's been a tendency to focus on Africa, I guess, and the Middle East. But I think there's enough to build on. And I think with us being more inclined to work with the United Nations, I think that augurs well.
It's an interesting question. I asked... And the responsibility to protect. I asked Anne-Marie Slaughter about this. She's the new head of policy planning at the State Department and is generally credited with being one of the major architects of the doctrine of responsibility to protect. And her response was not dissimilar from John's. You know, we got to learn about this and put together case studies over time and gather experience, and nations have to learn how to deal with this, regional groupings have to learn to deal with this. And she drew a parallel with the human rights area, which she said was brand new when that began aggressively in the early 1970s. And President Carter then picked it up, and Warren Christopher built it into what the State Department was doing in the early 70s. And then there was an assistant secretary and a human rights report. And over a period of time, you know, we began to build a much more aggressive and increasingly successful set of norms for, you know, what was expected in terms of behavior related to human rights. Obviously, we're not doing perfectly in that area yet by any means, but You know, there is a much more accepted approach to this now than there was then. And
I see you shaking your head. What? Well, why don't you elaborate? Well, why don't you explain it in a different way?
Well, they were pretty good answers, but maybe we didn't get the right question.
Go ahead.
The point is, how do you reconcile responsibility to protect with the veto? Legitimate but illegal means we don't pay attention to the veto. And the point of the veto, in effect, is to prevent the repetition of the First and Second World Wars. You can accept minor aggressions if the risk is two great powers or two great alliances clashing with each other. My concern now is you're beginning to see a new division emerging. Reset buttons are no.
Well, okay. Well, we ought to go into this a little bit. Most of these responsibility to protect situations, it seems to me, are human rights / humanitarian situations that don't really involve rivalries between the great powers. Somalia, I don't know, Haiti, whatever. And where it seems to me we can both agree that they're urgent situations requiring attention. I don't think either of us are going to veto each other when we talk about the urgency of those situations. The harder part is whether we're really willing to accept the mandate to really protect people, or whether we're just, if I've understood the thrust of your question, or are we just going to send peacekeepers in to maintain a peace? And what do we do when we see people starting to kill each other in the Eastern Congo or something like that? Do the peacekeepers go in and really protect people? And we've seen mixed results in the way UN peacekeeping forces have behaved. Sometimes they've done absolutely nothing, and sometimes they've done something to, you know, make their influence felt. But I'm not sure I see that many Georgia situations around. I mean, it would seem to me that for your question to have a lot of meaning, you'd have to have a number of analogous types of interventions where our interests are kind of diametrically opposed. And I don't see that happening. Sorry.
I would just add one thing to your point. The responsibility to protect, which is now international law because it was part of the reform packages that were approved in 2005, are a three-part duty, of which the UN fulfills many parts by sending peacekeepers, by providing prevention, and I think the challenging part is how this evolves in the course of the history of the institution. But it was part of In Greater Freedom, the report that the Secretary General, Kofi Annan, put forth, and is now the law. So I think what we're looking at is an evolution of a doctrine, as you so well stated. But maybe we can go on to some other questions. I saw Will Davis's hand up and a gentleman next to him. So, Will, let's take...
He's a ringer.
I'm sorry.
He's a ringer.
Thanks, Johanna, and thank you for your report. United Nations and reform are never far from each other in a sentence. And now that reform has become so much a part of the lexicon when you discuss the United Nations, and deservedly so, from your experience, Mr. Ambassador, what one or two things do you think would help the organization be more effective, and how would you get those one or two things? And obviously, Senator Worth as well, you've had long experience looking at the UN now. What would help us move forward in the United Nations to make it do its job better, without perhaps all of this distraction on Security Council reform or other things that seem to occupy so much time?
Well, we mentioned arrears. I think that's important. I'm not sure I would spend much time on Security Council reform because it's an endless debate. And no matter how many members you have, whether it's the original 11, I think it started out at, or 15, or 26, you're going to still have some of the same issues. The Secretariat, I think we've probably focused a bit too much on Secretariat reform as distinct from working harder to show our commitment and engagement with the UN, and then as a consequence of that engagement, trying to mobilize the rest of the international community through partnership.
if you spend your time sitting on the sidelines dinging the United Nations, you're probably not going to get the same kind of collaborative behavior as if you said, okay, we're with you, we want to make it work, now let's roll up our sleeves and work together to get it done. To me, it comes back down to that issue of what's the definition of the United Nations. And to me, maybe a slight variance from what Tim has been talking about, I don't see it so much as these different agencies and the Secretariat. I think of it as the member states mustering the political will to get stuff done. And we've got to lead in that.
The question, the gentleman next to Will.
Yes, you know, I'd like to just ask about the founding. Oh, Dan Gibbons, Project on National Security Reform. I'd like to ask a little bit about the founding developments vis-a-vis UN. You know, when Franklin Roosevelt era, you know, and Harry Truman, where the organization was initially proposed with a Security Council focus to perform a certain specific function in the world. This was the founding mandate for it. And, of course, with the Cold War, this went by the wayside. We formed NATO to fulfill some of that function. Now that the Cold War is over, is there a future for a we're having trouble with Russia-NATO relations. Is there an integrative function that the UN could perform in this particular area of reuniting the Cold War powers and returning to that original mandate?
I understand the question.
I mean, I think my short answer would be that I'd be skeptical of that, because I think that's something that these powers have to do between themselves in the first instance. I mean, it's got to be between Russia and the United States and China. And by the way, I mean, notwithstanding Georgia, I think the relations between the larger powers at this particular juncture in history are rather benign compared to other times of the world. I very often comment, imagine dealing with the global financial and economic crisis if it were in a period of great Cold War tension. Yeah, it would have been more difficult.
Yes, this gentleman.
Rajit Das, UNA-NCA. My question for you, sir, is how does the U.S. balance its influence that it has with a country outside the UN versus the same relationship it has with the same country within the UN? For example, the U.S. has strengthened its bilateral relationship with India, like through the civilian nuclear deal, yet hasn't fully supported India's bid for the UN Security Council.
Yeah, it's a great question to which I'm not sure I have a very good answer. I can give you a couple of different examples, though, of how these things can turn out. Mexico wanted very badly back in 2002 or 2001 to be elected to the Security Council, and they did. They got elected, and in fact, they came into the race late in the game when the Dominican Republic was already slated to become the regional candidate for the hemisphere. And I think it's a decision that the government of Mexico ultimately related, because it put the government at odds with us on the Iraq question. And this is a country for whom the bilateral relationship with the United States was extremely important. So sometimes when you decide on becoming an elected member of the Security Council, you got to go through that phase of being careful what you wish for and think it all through. I'm not saying, and actually Mexico's back on the Security Council now, and I don't think there's any big issue between us, but it can create tensions of that kind, and we've had other situations where a bilateral issue somehow impinges on the Security Council membership or vice versa. And there's a lot of, it's a dynamic situation.
Got to remember, consistency is not the mother's milk of politics.
Mm-hmm. That too.
I mean, and you got to deal
That's
with
right.
it. I mean, you have relationships that are where you have five or six or seven things in which you are in great agreement, and you learn how to deal with one or two areas where you don't have disagreements. And good diplomacy, what people like John Negroponte did, was build those five or six or seven positive things so you've got credit, you know, and you're going to deal with one of the places where you may have strong disagreement, and you move ahead. And you don't get stuck up on those. It's very, very important to have the ambiguities of all of these pieces.
Let me jump back in on this, because I think the only time I can think of during my tenure as ambassador to the UN, and I think probably since, where something ongoing at the Security Council was really a matter of tension between the member states, was the debate on the second Iraq resolution. But apart from that, maybe the question of the International Criminal Court, although I think the council came around, we finally worked out an accommodation. I had the most horrendous instructions one day, came in over a weekend saying, go in and veto Resolution X. I think it was renewing the mandate for peacekeeping forces in Bosnia or something like that, and veto it unless it's made clear in that resolution that the ICC won't apply to the peacekeeping forces. And this shocked everybody else in the room. I mean, everybody went scampering out, the headlines screaming all over the place, and there was a sort of a scandal for several days. The Canadian perm rep, who wasn't even on the Security Council, was running around sort of mobilizing the whole United Nations against us. And, within two or three, I don't know, maybe a week or two, Abdul, I don't know whether you were on the council at that time or not. Ambassador Bali is the ambassador of Algeria here, and he was a colleague at the Security Council at one point. But we worked out an accommodation. So even the ICC was not that contentious an issue in the end.
Okay. A few more questions. This lady in the middle, please.
Hi, I'm Mindy Reiser from the United Nations Association of the National Capital Area. By the way, we're having our model UN today at the State Department, and Hillary Clinton spoke, so I think that's
great.
Really a wonderful thing. This is a question about the Peace Building Commission. It's a little known entity that has done some things in Sierra Leone and I think Liberia, with some more entities on the horizon. I'd like to know what kind of future this has. This is in addition, of course, to peacekeeping operations and blue helmets, but it's an initiative to do some proactive post-conflict diplomacy. How does this mesh perhaps with some of the economic development work, some of the health work? It's all a package, and I'm fearful that all of this is very fragmented and the various entities that could collaborate really aren't doing a good job. So, in short, what hope is there for the little peace-building initiative?
I'd put that in the answer to that in the context of broader thinking of the peacekeeping mandate overall. You know, one of the things that I, you know, think that Mrs. Rice is doing is looking at peacekeeping sort of from the beginning to the end. And if you look down at the beginning, you know, if we're going to launch peacekeeping missions, you know, what do we do to make sure that they are more effective, make sure that you've got a better command and control, what can be done early on to try to make them in such a way that things don't get out of control, and how do you intervene perhaps earlier, and that becomes duty to protect. There's a whole complex of items that occur early on. You know, this is the UN reform issue. The question was asked earlier about UN reform, and this is one of the more interesting packages, subtle, difficult, not as easy to rail about as accounting practices or food for, you know, the Iraqi food situation, but a very, very important one because peacekeeping is so central. And then at the other end of that process is what happens post-peacekeeping mission. You know, it doesn't do any good, or we know from our own experience, you don't just go into a situation without some sense of what happens at the end of it. You know, you've got to think about if you're going to send peacekeepers into a particular situation, you don't just send them in, vote to send them in and say, take care of that problem, on to the next one. You know, you've got to think through a longer continuum. And that's where the Peace Building Commission was an important first step. Now, it's only, what, 3 years old or 4 years old, minimally funded. I think it has a budget of maybe $50 million max, you know, coming from a couple of countries. But we're learning about that as well. This is a new process, and it's very important. You know, you have to remember you can't send in a peacekeeping mission if there's no peace to keep. You know, it's impossible to ask those peacekeepers to do things. That's what are the conditions of going in and then coming out. How do you come out and build a Sierra Leone situation after the peacekeepers are done? Then who moves in, and how do you help to create that? That's, I think, part of this continuum of thinking about reform of the whole peacekeeping operation. At least that's how I would view the new commission.
Let me ask you both a question based on what you've just said. Every meeting I go to on stabilization and reconstruction ultimately has this default, and it's called the United Nations. When everything else exits, the UN remains because of the agencies that are on the ground, because of the other issues that the UN takes care of, from food to water to health. But the sustainability of this is going to require resources. And I guess I wonder, especially as we're in two very complex theaters in Afghanistan and Pakistan and other parts of the world where the UN has already committed 18 or 19 missions right now, if this is the default strategy, how do we reinforce it? How do we get our friends and allies to be part of this partnership in spite of the leadership?
Afghanistan, I know that the UN, conversations I've recently had, is very worried, you know, about what's the expectation going to be. I mean, not worried, but, you know, what is the expectation going to be of the UN and UN agencies, you know, over a period of time in Afghanistan, and who's going to pay for it? And that was certainly part of what the president was attempting to do at the G20 meeting, was to begin to anticipate this and to get support for, let's hope, that a period of time in which there becomes a modicum of political stability and the peace-building agencies can move in. And a lot of that's going to be the UN, and somebody's going to have to pick up that tab. It's probably going to be a very significant tab, and I know that the UN's very worried about where that money will come from. The expectation will be very, very high that the UN's going to handle that, right? And got to make sure that those resources are there.
Yeah, I'm not sure at the moment the UN, I mean, people are really thinking in terms of matching what individual nations and the multilateral financial institutions provide by the way of longer-term assistance. I mean, you're getting into many more billions of dollars than is involved in the United Nations budget, so that's an issue. Seems to me, with respect to the Peacebuilding Commission, one of the issues is the question of managing a transition and just exactly, you know, how you want to position those activities. I mean, clearly there's the closer you are to the end time of the conflict, the more you could see a role for that organization. But the longer time that goes on, it seems to me you've got to find a way to transition it back to other institutions. I'd just like to add, having been ambassador to Iraq, you also, it's very important to know where you are in the process. Are you in a war? Are you in a peace? Are you in a reconstruction phase? Because I arrived in Iraq when most of my government thought we were in a reconstruction phase, and we were actually at the beginning of a war, at the beginning of an insurgency. And so, you know, it's important to know where you are.
The gentleman in the rear, I see a couple of the questions.
Hi.
It's true.
Kevin O'Shea from the Canadian Embassy. I was not one of those diplomats chasing John in New York about the International Criminal Court.
But you remember Paul Heinbecker, though, don't you?
My question is, essentially the report says, in terms of investing in a new multilateralism, that the best way forward is for the United States, in those areas where the United States and the UN are aligned, let's move ahead and make concrete, realistic progress. The one example I'd like to get your views on is, in many ways, Darfur was almost sort of the case study for the responsibility to protect. And in many ways, the UN and U.S. interests were very well aligned in that. Yet, we didn't make much progress. I guess my question is, John, and you probably were dealing with in the Bush administration.
I was.
What further could you have done in terms of the Bush administration, or what further can the Obama administration move in that area where essentially UN, U.S. are aligned, but we still seem to be at a stalemate?
Right. And, of course, there, some of the things we did, I think, were very right. But the U.S., of course, first of all, was the largest provider of humanitarian assistance to the camps and to the refugees. And I think it was the largest humanitarian program we had, all in all, when you counted the food that that was being supplied either directly or through the World Food Program. And we did get up to the point where we approved, I think, something on the order of 26,000 peacekeepers. And then the whole thing got mired down in whether Mr. Bashir would accept them and all the conditionality he kept putting on this, and the inability of the international community and the Secretary General to overcome those objections. Frankly, I've lost the bubble a bit. I don't know whether we've gotten all those 26,000 peacekeepers in there yet or not. I see Abdullah shaking his head. Well, that means the Arab group has not been doing its work, Abdullah. I think we could have been a bit more forceful, but I think it requires some real diplomacy with Mr. Bashir. And also, the other thing where we really lost a bit of traction was the rebel group started to atomize and fragment. I mean, when Bob Zelik negotiated the initial Darfur peace agreement, there were only two or three groups. By the end, they'd fragment into half a dozen or a dozen or so, and that made it problematic.
So then, Brent, I will never forget an evening at the new Secretary General's house in which we were talking about, somebody asked him about his reaction to his first 6 months or a year in office, and he immediately got to Darfur and to his frustration at the lack of support from the member states for what he had been asked to do. He said, I couldn't possibly operate if we have 26,000 troops. I can't possibly operate without lift, without the capacity to move around the country. Then we went to the U.S. to get helicopters, and they weren't there. I went to the Russians, and they said no. Went to NATO, and NATO said no. Went to the Brazilians, and the Brazilians said no. Went to the Indians, and they said no. And he said, we finally had to lease old Russian helicopters from the Ethiopian Air Force, and then at that we could only do a handful. He said, he was just reflecting on his own frustrations of being in this. I don't think this is, out of school to tell us. I think he was reflecting his own frustrations about we're asked to do these things at the Secretariat level to take on this set of responsibilities, but where are the member states then in terms of providing the support that's necessary? Going back to a point that John made right at the beginning, we have to make sure when we're starting to get into this that the member states, who actually are calling the shots, it is a member state-driven institution.
There's an allergy in our military and in the Pentagon to re-engaging in Africa. I think it goes back to Somalia in the 1990s, and it applies to Sudan, to the issue you just discussed. It applies also, unless things have changed, to airlifting of peacekeeping troops into the country. And frankly, to broaden the discussion a bit, it applies to Somalia itself, because I think at the informal level, a lot of us in the previous administration thought we ought to have peacekeeping, UN peacekeeping operations in Somalia. And I don't think it would necessarily take that much of a peacekeeping effort to restore a modicum of security and stability to at least Mogadishu. But, people's eyes would really glaze over when I started talking about that in the previous administration. I suspect I might get the same reaction today.
I think this raises then going back to the question about sort of peacekeeping we keep touching on, and one of the interesting relationships that I think, ought to get strengthened is the relationship between the Secretary General, the PERM rep, and the Pentagon, to really understand these relationships in a better and clearer way. And that may be, where maybe the Pentagon is now so overwhelmed with everything else that it has to do, but to understand, what ought to be done and how we think about the number of peacekeeping operations and how those get equipped and, what the command structure is going to be and how we provide that assistance. It's my impression that years ago the U.S. provided significantly more kind of permanent assistance to peacekeeping operations in the U.N., but of course there were many fewer of them at that point than there are now. But this is a very, I think, a very fuzzy area that demands, Joanna, a lot of, it's going to demand a lot clearer thinking and a lot more work than I know about is going into this.
Well, one opportunity, just to mention something related to the Pentagon, is in the Quadrennial Defense Review, which is now starting, one of the priorities is to look at civilian response capacity. Obviously, it's for the United States, but I think there's an opportunity there to also bring in the capacity that the UN already has on the ground. It may not be perfect, but we don't have a perfect answer either. So to the extent that there's an opportunity to re-engage in this issue, this may be the right moment, given the openness of the Obama administration.
Well, it's an interesting question. Maybe there's a way, and we ought to put together.
And I think there's greater receptivity in amongst our military to peacekeeping generally, because I think they finally see that it is an alternative.
It is the force multiplier.
Exactly.
Well, maybe we ought to talk to Will Davis or somebody at the UN and say maybe this is an opportunity to think about, you know, some very smart and experienced people who've been working on this to start to look at this again. Maybe this is a window of one of the most important sets of relationships between the U.S. and the U.N., and this is an opportunity to sort that out. That window may be there now.
And because there are also, as you mentioned earlier, humanitarian catastrophes that are connected with many of these conflictive areas, we already have the precedent of working, and I think this could be the next opportunity.
Get Negroponte and Dobbins and put them on a commission and see if they can sort this baby out, right?
Well, I'd
Dobbins and Worth, I think.
I see we have two hands. This gentleman and the others.
I'm Harry Inman, a lawyer.
About that?
In regard to Somalia, should we revisit the trustee system? Would that support peacekeeping?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably not a very politically correct idea. I mean, but in effect, some of the kinds of work that is done by the international community in these countries is not that different from what trusteeships were about previously. But I don't think you'll ever go back. You can't turn the clock back, and I don't think you'll ever go back to that. Certainly can't go back to that terminology. But there's certainly some functions there that could be carried out, I would suspect. I mean, otherwise, you know, what's going to happen in Somalia? Is it just going to continue to be ungoverned? I don't know. Or minimally governed?
Let's take a last round of questions and then let our guests. Okay.
I'm Manuel Lafont-Apnouy. I'm a visiting fellow here at CSIS. I have a question. I think we obviously could all agree that there are renewed conditions for U.S. leadership in the U.N., but the leadership needs a followership. In the UN, to act effectively, you need a majority to reform the UN even more so. And the condition to build a majority in the UN have changed because the world is more fragmented, because the world is, the global order is multipolar, because the world is less westernized or western-centered than it used to be. And so the way you build this coalition probably have changed. I'd like to have your ideas about it, and do you think this strategy to build coalition is just, as you have elaborated a lot about just what the new administration called the power of the U.S. example rather than the example of the U.S. power, or are there other things that the U.S. should do to build this coalition?
Right, and I don't think, even though it's changed, and I would agree with the thrust of your question, I don't think that the strategy is that difficult. I think it involves coalition building. When you think about it, it really isn't that many different countries because it's basically like the permanent members of the Security Council. It's the European Union. It's the BRICS, the BRIC countries. I mean, example, in the whole debate about climate change, at the end of the Bush administration, we sponsored the creation of a so-called major economies meeting, and it was 15 countries, if I'm not mistaken, and they accounted for something like 80 or 90% of carbon emissions in the world. And actually, that model of that 15 major economies probably could be transferred over to non-environmental issues as well. So I think the coalition can be built, and it wouldn't require that much effort, and a lot of it is already there in terms of the kind of diplomatic efforts we make.
It may be easier because you don't get as monolithic a non-aligned movement and G77 movement. It's much more fragmented in terms of the possibilities of creating this sort of coalition where you get new members that want to come into this all the time for their own reasons, for their own purposes.
Take that in the G20, for example, and you've got a lot of overlap there, too.
I see. Two questions, this lady, and then Ambassador Fritchie.
Sabine Muscat with the Financial Times Deutschland. You have, both gentlemen have already voiced their views on the UN Security Council reform. You were saying you wouldn't spend that much time on it. Nevertheless, it's going in a new round right now. And what do you think, what can countries like Germany, for example, where I come from, expect from that? Or what could they hope from that process? How should they go about it? And the other question, you've mentioned Ambassador Rice and her close relations to the president. Are there any examples? Have you seen a shift in U.S. style already? How would you say she has performed in her first weeks at the U.N.? Thank you.
Maybe she got the budget thing. I mean, I would take that right immediately. I think the success on the budget has been... that's the first and most important marker that was out there, and she was extraordinarily successful, I think, in getting that done. It's a real tribute to her, and that's the toughest thing there is. You know, particularly if it's the first time around. I thought she did great. What do you think about this?
Well, on the Security Council question, I think I said it earlier. I just wouldn't hold out much hope for Security Council reform because it has so many moving parts and no one's ever satisfied, and one country will only agree if there's another. If India, why not Pakistan? If Brazil, why not Mexico? If so on and so forth. So it's quite difficult. And I frankly, to be honest with you, I don't think the permanent members are that interested in Security Council.
That's candid.
No.
Well, I'm not in the government anymore.
I
did my 44 years.
And
they're not that interested.
Ambassador Fritchie.
Thank you. Well, the gentleman over there, in my view, asked the perfect closing question, but I'm going to make my remarks anyway. First of all, I'd like to briefly come back, Ambassador Negroponte, to the International Criminal Court.
The Criminal Court,
yeah.
Right.
The United States, together with a group of other countries, was at the outset of bringing this institution about. And then, for reasons that we all know, we faced almost outright rejection by the U.S. to what I would consider today pragmatic cooperation. Against the background of your past experiences, what do you foresee or what do you think could and should be the U.S.-ICC
right.
relation? And Senator Worth, I just would like to pay tribute to the great work that you have been doing for years now through and with the UN Foundation. I don't think it gets enough credit, and unfortunately it's a fact that very often good news don't make news. But the UN Foundation works in some of the areas in which the UN is outstanding, and that includes health, education, humanitarian work. So my compliments.
Thank you. Ambassador, on the ICC, of course, it was the Clinton administration that signed it and then said they wouldn't submit it, if I remember correctly, to the Senate for ratification. Was an interesting approach. And we've kind of been, and then we unsigned it, if I remember correctly, and we proactively opposed it. Now we've moved into a slightly more pragmatic phase, as you suggest. One of the things that bothered me when I was there was that these special courts, the hybrid court, the court for this situation, Yugoslavia, for Rwanda, for et cetera, for Cambodia, it's not a cost-effective way to go about these things. First of all, the courts turn out to be extremely expensive in any event, hundreds of millions of dollars each, and then extraordinarily complicated to set up. Each one is a whole life's work for somebody, believe me. I mean, setting up the Cambodian court took eons. I mean, all the Khmer Rouge were going to die before this court was created. I mean, I think they almost all have. So it'd be good if, in principle at least, if we could get to the point where everybody could accept the international court, or maybe there's some modification that could be made to accommodate whatever our most serious concerns were. Make it more explicit that our troops couldn't be tried, provided our own legal system were adequate, etc. I mean, England and other countries didn't seem to have, the UK didn't seem to have the problems with the ICC that we did. But this gives me, I was wondering, and I almost forgot to mention this, and I really do think it's important to say, I think one of the ways this administration could show its commitment to the UN would be to, for once and for all, get the UN Law of the Sea Treaty ratified.
I was going to say that.
And I've often thought of the Law of the Sea, first of all, because of the merits, it's in the obvious self-interest of the United States to ratify this agreement from every possible point of view. But also, it would be the model of a treaty which we'd initially had some problems with, and then we got the international community to tweak it and modify it slightly to accommodate our substantive concerns. And having made that effort, I think it would be an act of good faith on our part to now ratify it. And that might open up some possibilities vis-a-vis the International Criminal Court as well. But that's just an added thought.
I couldn't agree more. It's beyond me why this has not. This is leadership, I'm afraid. You know, we've not seen the commitment from the White House to say we want this to happen. You know, Kerry's ready to do it. You got all the energy companies are ready to do it. You got all the environmental
communities
ready to do it.
Wants it.
The JCS wants it to happen. You got a couple of nutball senators who are saying this is lots of, you know. But as soon as the idea is they're going to have, I said that. You don't have to. But as soon as they say we're ready to go on this, it'll happen. You know, and that is, you know, where does this end up in terms of a priority? The administration just has to say, leadership, we're going to do this. Now, I think once that happens, then you get, you know, an opportunity to work on rights of the child and on CEDAW, and then you can take on the more complicated ICC situation down the line. But you got to move into it and get people, again, accustomed to the fact that, you know, the Senate can get 67 votes. You can do this in a bipartisan way. These are very reasonable things to do, and let's just go do it.
I think with those words, unless Ambassador Negroponte, you would like to add to those, I want to thank you on behalf of CSIS for a quite enjoyable conversation about an issue that is going to require more conversations, but obviously we've started on a good note of looking forward, and I appreciate both of you spending some time with us.
And good report, Joanna.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.